For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. With me is Caitlin. How you doing, Caitlin?
I'm doing okay. How about you, Mark?
We are both struggling under considerable burdens, but we are far too noble to complain or indeed make a play for sympathy. We are going to work through the pain. We are going to overcome all obstacles. And in so doing, we are going to talk about some video games. We're going to talk about what we've been playing lately. We're going to talk about our retro game of the week in our goof segment. We're going to talk about The Legend of Zelda, The Ocarina of Time. I am not looking forward to goring those sacred cows. And then we're going to talk about our feature game, which is Raven's Watch. And then we're going to close it out by shouting out some upcoming titles with our shameless hyping. So, Caitlin, what have you been playing lately?
So, lately, if I'm being honest, I've mostly been playing Core Keeper. So, one of my friends hosts our server, so I got him to start it up. And we went and we ended up killing maybe three bosses. I think we have three left, or at least three according to what I know about the game. So that's cool. I've been having a lot of fun with that. And then other game that I've been playing a little bit is Factorio. That's not true. I've played Factorio once before this week, just for one day. And this was my second time trying it out from the beginning. We didn't resume anything because I wouldn't have remembered anything anyway. I guess they had a DLC. I'm not sure if it counts as an expansion, but there was a DLC that came out recently for Factorio that does space stuff. And we were like, ooh, we want to do space stuff. And of course, we did not get to the space stuff because we started very early in the game. But apparently there were a bunch of quality of life improvements. I don't know what any of those are because I don't remember the first time I played this game. But it was fun. I'm having a good time and looking forward to playing again more probably tonight. So.
Okay, this is perfect because I have 1,000 questions about Factorio. I have never touched Factorio, and I never will touch Factorio for the same reason that I have never touched Minecraft. Minecraft and Factorio are things that I keep hearing about, but mm-hmm. I don't really know. I know that Factorio allows you to set up all manner of automated things.
Yeah.
But I have no conception about what the fundamental structure, the play arc is of Factorio. How does it work? Or is it just some huge sandbox where they're like, hey, make a Turing machine out of these widgets?
Okay, so you land on this planet, this alien planet, and so to be fair, I don't actually know what the point is of like why you went there. Maybe it is to create an industrial haven or something. I don't know. But anyway, you get there. You have to gather up some materials, and at first, everything is very manual. You have to chop down trees, you make charcoal or whatever to make fuel in order to smelt the copper that you also manually mined, and then eventually you get machines that can do the mining for you, machines that can pick up the stuff that got mined and move it to the smelter automatically, stuff that can move stuff from the smelter to a chest for you to grab stuff out of. Automation is tricky for me because I often have this mental block where it's like, yes, if I knew exactly how to get this whole automation system working first try, then I would just do it. But because there's that learning curve of getting there, I'm just like, oh, so frustrating. I'll just do it myself, which ultimately takes way longer. Like,
so automation feels like delegation to you and you're too much of a control freak.
Yeah, I think so.
all of this kind of makes sense to me, but only in the sense in the same way that universal paperclips make sense to me. Have you ever, are you familiar with universal paperclips, either in concept or in execution?
I'm not sure that I am.
Okay, I'll skip past the thought experiment and all the implications for AI. The point is that usually, in, especially in the context of video games, there's some kind of nominal structure for what's going on. Like, with the exception of some games like Mario Paint. Mario Paint didn't have any kind of structure at all, right? It was like, yeah. Hey, here's some stuff and levers you can pull and sandboxy stuff. And maybe you can make some stuff, or maybe you don't want to make some stuff. And if you don't want to make some stuff, what are you doing here? Go away. And I definitely get the sense that for a lot of people, Factorio is kind of like Mario Paint. Like, I see people posting, like, look at this insane thing that I did in the context of Factorio. And my question is, for somebody who plays the game on a much more simplistic level, is there any structure that Factorio offers to you?
Structure is a difficult word. I mean, maybe. So there is a technology tree. So you're unlocking things that you probably will get the inkling that, like, yes, I just unlocked conveyor belts. I probably should use those somehow. But there's no... There actually might be a tutorial, but as far as I know, there's not a tutorial.
See, I know you too well. I wasn't going to ask you so obvious a question of that.
Yeah. There very well may be a tutorial, but if there is, I didn't play it, naturally. My friend, who has played Factorio before, acted as our tutorial. Like, he helped me, like, yes, we should do X or we should do Y. I think that this would have been a very difficult game for me to get into without him there to help guide the rest of us who were Factorio newbies. And so it'd be really hard to say, like, what the game would be like without him doing that. I imagine that I would have gotten quickly overwhelmed with the amount of stuff that there was and needing to learn how to use all of these different things and may have just bounced. But who knows?
It definitely seems daunting. It seems like a very deep pool of things you can do. My question is just, and this is not my implying that games have to have some kind of structure, by no means.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to wrap my head around the kind of thing that it is and that it's trying to be, because it is so utterly unlike what I go to video games to do. You know, this is an efficiency puzzle that, insofar as you solve it, it allows you to be more efficient for the next efficiency puzzle. Like, when the moment you said, I unlocked conveyor belts, I might as well start using them. I'm like, yeah, this is totally not for Mark. My instincts to stay away from this were very, very good. The same thing with Minecraft. Like, I see people build a one-to-one scale replica of the Starship Enterprise D in Minecraft. I'm like, that's super impressive. And I'm genuinely pleased that humanity has reached a state where we can engage in this kind of bizarre Ouroboros, a snake eating its own tail kind of cultural representation, and I want no part of this, because I'm that kid who didn't like playing with Lego and didn't like arts and crafts, right? But my understanding is that Minecraft, if you want to play it with a kind of structure, has a kind of structure. And, like, Stardew Valley has a kind of structure. There's a nominal set of stuff. Like, you talked about Corekeeper. A Corekeeper has a kind of structure. Even Luna Island, which I can't help but notice you're back to Corekeeper. All of these games can have an infinite amount of faffing about and just wasting time off on the side, but nominally there's some kind of overall structure that could tie your activities together if you want them to. Another analogy, I guess, just to beat this into the ground, is No Person's Sky. In No Person's Sky, there's nominally an overarching, like, and even at launch, people were like, well, I found the core. Is that it? But at least it had something.
Right? Yeah.
And my question is, and it looks like the answer may be no, is there anything comparable in Factorio? And you don't seem to have encountered it yet.
I don't think there is. If there are quests, I didn't notice them.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, there's aliens on the planet that will attack you. You need to eventually defend against attacks once you start polluting the planet so much that the aliens get mad at you.
Oh my goodness, this is universal paperclips. This is totally, okay. But it's not about AI. This is colonialism. This is the colonialism equivalent of universal paperclips. That's clearly what it is.
Yeah.
You show up on this planet for no reason. You start strip mining the resources for you don't know why and start processing them. You're not sure why. The aliens show up and it seem to object and you're like, well, clearly I should just kill them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I did. I mean, they're like bloodthirsty, Zerg-like aliens. So I didn't feel that bad, but I did feel a little bad because, like, I'm really just I'm invading your territory and taking all your stuff and polluting your planet, and I'm probably just going to leave at the end.
See, bloodthirsty implies that they crave violence for the sake of violence, and so that's what you did was you first identified them as bloodthirsty, and then you adduced two excellent reasons as to why they might want to kill you.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying.
I feel like this is going back to that very first episode when we talked about Shadow of Mordor.
No, I'm not asserting that there's any kind of fundamental racial politics going on here.
Oh, no, not this, that part. But, yeah.
So maybe, I guess, let me put it this way. When and if Factorio issues the DLC, where it turns the entire game into a real-time strategy game where you're controlling the indigenous population, check in with me then, and then okay. We might discover that this was, in point of fact, a pointed parable about colonialism the entire time.
Sounds good. I'll do that.
But you've been having a good time with Factorio.
Yeah, with friends. Honestly, with friends. I don't know if I would enjoy it solo, but I haven't tried either, so who knows?
Well, thank you for clarifying it. I have a number of friends who've played Factorio, and I've seen a lot of demonstrations about what the engine can do.
Yeah.
I just, as I said, I didn't understand it as a game, and I feel like I've got a much better understanding about what it is now. So, thank you.
Yeah, for me, like, the game that I think of, because I played it first, not because for any other reason, but is Oxygen Not Included, which also had a lot of automation things, and also was something where I struggled a lot with getting over certain tiers because of that. Although I felt Oxygen Not Included had more of a structure to it than Factorio does. But that could be, I played many more hours of Oxygen Not Included than I did Factorio.
Or maybe the structure is only evident if you play the tutorial.
If there is one, yeah.
So I've been playing more Dead Cells. Dead Cells, in many ways, is one of the originators of the roguelite genre. And this is a roguelite Metroidvania. And so it's an action platformer where you sometimes have permadeath and sometimes have enduring upgrades. And among some of the enduring upgrades that persist between runs are things that open up new areas of the map. For example, one of the first ones you unlock, I'm not making this up, is an ability that lets you tickle vines, and then the vines grow up and allow you to access new areas of the map. And this indeed highlights one of the things that I don't really like about Dead Cells. It's got a sense of humor that I don't really vibe with.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a sort of ironic tone, and I don't object to that necessarily. I just don't find the writing particularly amusing. It's not obnoxious, it's just kind of there. And the overall plot presentation is opaque at best. And when there is any representation of any actual narrative, my first reaction tends to be more of the, huh, what variety, rather than, oh, that was interesting. And I played a ton of Dead Cells a few years ago. And this is salient for two reasons. Number one, I am not any better at Dead Cells than I was near the beginning of my playing with it. Like, other roguelites, I get a lot better. Mm-hmm. And I look back, you know, Risk of Rain is a primary example. Any of the Risks of Rain, I'm much, much better now than I was when I started. Even the game we're going to be talking about later, I'm much better now than when I started. But Dead Cells, I'm still solidly mediocre, which is impressive. Given the number of hours that I put in, you'd figure that I would have been able to beat the game on more than one boss cell, but I haven't. And so that's striking to me. And number two, I never really had much experience with the DLC. There's a whole bunch of DLC available. One of them is free. The rest of them are paid, but of course they go on sale on the reg. And if you have a Netflix membership, not only do you have access to the Android version of Dead Cells for free, but all the DLC is included. So yay on that.
Hmm.
The most recent one is a sort of Castlevania crossover thing. And a Belmont shows up, and Alucard shows up, and you fight Dracula, and there's a whole bunch of new whips and a whole bunch of other stuff, and it's kind of cool. And so there's a whole bunch of new biomes, a whole bunch of new enemies, a whole bunch of new things to unlock that I never had access to a few years ago. And so there's just enough new content so that I am enjoying revisiting a game that I played a lot of about 5 years ago, mm-hmm. and also experiencing new stuff dribbled in. This is, however, underlying my resolve not to play roguelites in early access, because this is in many ways kind of like what it would be to play a roguelite in early access, right? I play it a bunch at a certain point, I kind of play as much as I want, and then I mm-hmm. come back a few years later when there's more stuff. And if that more stuff were like the final pass of finish, that is not the way that I would like to experience it. So the entire time that I'm kind of getting new stuff mixed in with the old stuff, I'm thinking, oh yeah, I definitely want to wait for Hades 2 to be done before I touch that. because this is not the ideal way to experience new things, except in very, very particular circumstances that I wouldn't necessarily be able to replicate easily.
Yeah.
And so it's good to have your life choices validated in that kind of fundamental way. And honestly, in terms of action platforming, it's very much a sort of Dark Souls vibe. You know, you've got a refillable health flask that takes time to consume. You've got a dodge roll. It can be very punishing if you don't approach things in the proper way. Mm-hmm. If you want to parry, you can equip a shield and do the parry thing. I am not a parry person, so I do not equip shields.
Okay, I was going to ask about parrying.
Yeah, not my vibe. Maybe if I could parry, then I'd be able to beat the game on more than one boss cell. But alas, here we are. I will say that I'm very glad at some of the new passes of equipment and so forth, because in a more narrow equipment pool, you can kind of gravitate towards the same set of tools mm-hmm. and just deploy the same ones over and over and over again. And when you have a slightly bigger pool, you're forced to deal with the items and equipment that the game provides you somewhat at random. Because I can tell you, in the very early days of my playing Dead Cells, I spent a lot of time just deploying arrow traps and waiting. That was a thing that I did all the time.
Yeah.
It was fine, a sort of training wheels. So maybe I have gotten a little bit better at Dead Cells. I don't have to rely exclusively on arrow traps and buzzsaw traps. And so I'm actually able to engage in melee with the scary monsters rather than hiding around a corner waiting for my traps to do my work for me. I don't know.
Proud of you.
Yeah, baby steps. I was inspired to go back to Dead Cells because of the release of the Dead Cells board game.
Mm.
And I was, you know, just reminded of some of the touchstones there. I can definitely assert that the board game is not particularly good.
Okay.
Certainly not when compared to the Slay the Spire board game. But in fairness, as I've said in another podcast, it is easier to make a Slay the Spire board game because Slay the Spire has always been a board game.
Yeah.
So they got kind of a leg up there. But Dead Cells has been great to go back to. It's available on pretty much every platform. And as I say, if you've got a Netflix subscription at any level, you can try it out on Android. It is the granddaddy of the action roguelites for a reason. I think it's aged pretty well. It's got very fluid animation. And the other thing that's really striking, and again, kind of contributes to my sense of it not having much of a personality in terms of narrative or tone, mm-hmm. is that it has been willing to do not only just the recent crossover with Castlevania, it has crossed over with so many indie game properties. Just reference upon reference upon reference. Did you like Hollow Knight? Oh, there's some Hollow Knight in there. You like Risk of Rain? There's some Risk of Rain in there. You like all these other indie games? Oh, we've got references to indie games aplenty. It's a little much. Like at the point where you discover the crowbar blueprint behind a crab alien that was on somebody's face, I get it. I see what you're doing. I see what you're doing, Dead Cells. It's fine, I guess. But maybe take 20% off the top. And I say this as somebody who is a huge, huge fan of Risk of Rain. So even when they included that outfit, I was like, oh, come on, guys, seriously.
I know. It's funny because I feel like every now and then I'm just browsing my Steam library. And then I see, like, I click on some random game and I see some, you know, recent news that's some Dead Cells, like, collab. I'm like, everybody is collaborating with Dead Cells, apparently.
It's true. It is the DJ Khaled of indie games. Have you played Dead Cells?
No, actually. That is one that I ended up missing. I own it because, of course, I do. I bought it when it was on sale someday, but I have not played it yet.
Caitlin, such is my knowledge of you and your gaming habits. Notice I did not ask if you owned Dead Cells. I assumed you did.
I know.
I asked if you played Dead Cells. It is a solid design, and the action platforming is super tight. It is extraordinarily well done. And if it is your kind of thing, it is absolutely your kind of thing. I very, very much like action platforming roguelites. Astral Ascent and Dead Cells are probably the two best that I've ever played. And so if you derived any joy from Astral Ascent, and I know you did, Dead Cells has a lot less personality mm-hmm. and a lot less character to it, but it definitely has a faster pace and is more accessible in terms of the rules systems. You're not loaded down with a whole bunch of different buffs. Like, for example, you can poison things. You know how poison works.
Yeah.
You can inflict bleed on your enemies. Guess what? You also know how bleed works. So, as opposed to Astral Ascent, which if you'll recall, dear listeners, both of our complaints was that there was a dizzying array of modifiers and weird stats that was sometimes worth investigating. But even as somebody who's knee-deep in the systems of Astral Ascent, I acknowledge that it was a little bit more than it needed to be. Maybe it was the kind of thing that an aggressive tutorial would help. But anyway, that is Dead Cells, released back in 2018. It was an early access first, but I do not acknowledge a game until it's out of early access.
Mm-hmm.
I've been having a great time revisiting it. I'll probably do a few more runs. I have like a billion handheld emulation devices with controls attached, and so it is good to have it available on the go.
Let's move on to our gaming opinions on old school funware segment, aka Goof, where we're going to be talking about Ocarina of Time.
Hey, listen! Sorry, I don't know who said that.
Yeah, some annoying chick, probably. that sounded rude.
Sorry, Joe Rogan says what?
No! I don't have a good relationship with Navi. She annoys me.
I don't know that anyone likes her. Okay, so why don't we start here? I mean, everyone knows Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, right?
Yes.
Released in 98 by Nintendo EAD for the Nintendo 64. So let's just start with Navi. So I have been hearing for years about Navi. I've been hearing for years about Ocarina of Time generally. I'd never played Ocarina of Time more than about 30 minutes about 20 years ago.
Okay.
It's one of those things, it's on the list, right? The list has a whole bunch of all-time classics that Mark wants to go and try. Undertale was on that list. Ocarina of Time's on that list. There's a bunch of other games on that list, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been hearing about Navi for years. And so I start the game, and she's infamous. Infamous. Possibly infamous. She's the most famous thing about Ocarina of Time. She's definitely more famous than generic adventure boy wearing green. My relationship with Navi went from, I don't see what all the complaints are about, to, I wish to murder her in a fire in about 5 hot seconds. It was a very swift transition. But here's the thing, though, Caitlin.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a controversial claim.
Okay.
I think that Navi, to a certain extent, gets a bad rap. Because, yeah, she's annoying. Yeah, she's badly written. But I don't think she gets to shoulder all the hatred, because some of it, I think, is best directed towards video game design of the late 90s.
Sure. I can accept that, yeah.
And I think that she's just become the lightning rod for the fact that, and I'm just going to make a whole bunch of controversial claims that are going to make people hate me. All right?
Okay.
She's a lightning rod for the fact that the control scheme is garbage, the camera is garbage, and they hadn't really figured out how to do tutorials in a more slick way. Like, this was the early days of tutorializing in the late 90s. Some games had no tutorials, and you just had to read the instruction manual. And then some games had slightly more organic tutorials. Some had, you know, information dumps at the beginning of the game presented through text. Anyway, so yes, she's annoying, but I think a lot of it is because the game is kind of annoying. I don't hate Ocarina of Time, all right? I think it's fine. But it is very much a game of its era, and to a certain extent, I was not able to get past that. What is your experience with Ocarina of Time?
Okay, so Ocarina of Time is one I played back when it came out. It was my OG horse game.
Oh, sure.
I unlocked Epona, and then I didn't do any story for a solid 2 days because I was just having fun running around on Epona. So I have a lot of nostalgia kind of wrapped up in Ocarina of Time. I have various Ocarina tunes still fully memorized. Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot. Among all those things, though, which are all, you know, on the more positive side, I also remember trying to solve a puzzle and having Navi try to tell me what to do every 30 seconds and just being like, yeah, I know, I'm working on it. Please stop. So
part of me is curious, not curious enough to actually try it imminently. This is more maybe a project for not necessarily to get back on the list, the list that I referred to a few moments ago, but maybe almost that strong. It's been remastered a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
There is a 3DS version, for example, which apparently is vastly improved. I wonder if the Ocarina of Time had been released 3-4 years later, if I'd like it a lot more.
Hmm.
Because it is widely regarded as having innovated a number of gameplay systems that I think are not well done in Ocarina of Time. For example, just to pick one example, I've already talked about the camera. Complaining about games from the late 90s and the camera, whatever. I mean, yeah, we expect that to a certain extent.
That's standard.
But the whole contextual action button thing, right? You have one action button that does the overwhelming majority of your actions, and it changes contextually based on what you happen to be next to. There's a little on-screen display that indicates what the action is going to do. It just wasn't especially well done in conjunction with the movement systems. I would be in positions where I'd have to fiddle around for a moment with the analog stick to read a sign. It just wasn't very intuitive or smooth. At the time, it was very novel and innovative. Mm-hmm. But now, it's clunky and not well done. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the fundamental system. The fundamental conceit of the system is fine. The structure is good. In fact, almost everything about the structure of the Ocarina of Time is good. It's just the execution sometimes isn't very smooth, and to a certain extent, it's difficult to insist on innovation to also be smooth.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You talking about the new systems, this isn't exactly a new system, but it also reminded me that Ocarina of Time was the first game I played that used the Rumble Pack. And in fact, I at first thought that it required a Rumble Pack. It does not. It's very stupid. It barely does anything. I believe it's just to find some treasure that is buried in random places. Anyway, I was a little salty about the Rumble Pack when I realized like how not great it was.
Oh, Nintendo and their gimmicks. Yeah, the early days of haptic feedback were rough, generally speaking.
Yeah.
They can't all be winners.
No. Nope.
Yeah, it's just, again, Ocarina of Time is such a product of its era. It was literally, this is not a made-up story. I swear this is 100% true. I was playing through one of the early segments, and I was wrestling with the camera, trying to remember that, you know, the C buttons don't rotate the camera. Then, point of fact, you can't really rotate the camera at all. All you can do is snap to first-person view or snap to behind wherever green-hatted Adventure Boy is facing. And I was struggling to do that after I just hoisted up a wall, and I said, ugh. You know, the only thing that could make this more late 90s is a perfunctory and badly done stealth sequence. And literally the next screen, I'm serious, this is exactly what happened. I ran right into the perfunctory and unsatisfying stealth sequence. I could not believe it.
Wow, you really have a sixth sense for that, huh?
Apparently I'm a prophet of 90s game design. What can I say? It's just... Okay, so let's set aside the horse of it all.
Sure.
With difficulty.
Yes, right? With difficulty.
You eventually re-engaged with the core gameplay, yes?
Yes.
And you're one of the fans of Ocarina of Time, yes?
Yeah.
This is not a repeat of the Undertale situation. I thought... I enjoyed Ocarina of Time fine. I thought it was pretty good, which, given the technical limitations... Terrible graphics, terrible sound. Good at the time.
Yeah.
There was a close-up of Zelda, though, that genuinely made me uncomfortable. No, I mean it. It was just, you know, we've all seen them pointy polygons in a face, and it's like, why are you doing this close-up? You clearly were impressed with those graphics at the time.
Yeah.
But they have not aged well. I'm sorry.
And I have that thought about so many old games. Like, I understand that... Probably needed to start making games in 3D in order to make it better. It wasn't just going to magically get better. But early days for 3D, like thinking Final Fantasy VII, like, I mean, the battle sprites and stuff were great, but on the map, it was just like, oh my God, what is that? He doesn't have hands. He just has clubs. Like, what is going on? I just wanted so badly to go back to pixel art at that time. Like, at the time, it didn't look good. It's like, no, why are you zooming in on polygon face? It looks bad. So,
and
yeah.
for all the N64 stands, I will absolutely acknowledge that to a certain extent, this may be a strange claim, but I stand by it. I think PlayStation games get a bit of a pass because they were so much blurrier than N64 games. So consequently, number one, they look better now because they're just kind of all smudgy and we just get a more general effect. We don't see the incredible sharp edges of it.
Yeah.
Like, look, Solid Snake's face is not going to look good in a close-up. But this is the other thing. They know not to do those full frontal close-ups so that I feel like I'm going to get stabbed in the eye by Zelda's pointed nose.
Yeah.
Right? I respect the fact that the Nintendo technicians wanted to show off. They had this big open world. And by open, I mean empty. And you know, it was a cartridge-based format, so they had to use very, very low-quality MIDI music. That was one area where Sony had figured out the technical problems and had solved them. Like, Redbook Audio would have done wonders for Ocarina of Time. I'm sorry. I have a number of repeated complaints about the Nintendo 64 as a platform, and I feel like the Ocarina of Time just ran into most of them. I will say, getting to the actual level design, though.
Yeah.
And this was true of Minish Cap as well. When Zelda is doing its full dungeon thing, I should say Link, of course, but when Zelda games are doing the full dungeon thing, mm-hmm. and they're laying out these interesting environmental puzzles, I 100% understand the appeal and understand why these games are perennial classics. Mm-hmm. I have no difficulty understanding it. It's just the rest of the stuff that I find a little bit...
Yeah, I don't know. Like, for me, it's really difficult to unravel the nostalgia that is deeply threaded through all of Ocarina of Time for me. So I honestly can't even say why it is that I love it so much, or, yeah, I got nothing. I just know that I loved it as a child, and that has stuck with me.
There is a segment of retro gamers that, you know, still insist that Ocarina of Time is one of the greatest of all times. There's also a segment of Legend of Zelda stands that assert, and I think they've got a point, that Ocarina of Time has aged far less well than A Link to the Past. That A Link to the, like, if you want to talk mm-hmm. about perennial classics, it's Link to the Past, not Ocarina of Time, that you should be pointing to. Which is not to say that it's not a good game, it's just yeah. that, again, Ocarina of Time... I was personally not expecting for it to be quite so much a time capsule as other things. Most of the time, like, we've talked about a lot of games that are time capsules. I seem to be the one that bring this up, you know, these are the markers, this feels like such an early 90s game or turn of the century mm-hmm. game or whatever. But typically, these are not the games that are hailed as the greatest games of all time, with some yeah. exceptions. But Ocarina of Time is usually straight up there in the conversation, and it just hit me straight in the face with the late 90s hammer. And I was just dazed.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see that argument for A Link to the Past. I've been meaning to someday go back and replay it. I haven't played that since I was a child either. But I've always had warm, fuzzy feelings about it, even though Epona isn't in it.
Much less horse
yeah.
in A Link to the Past.
Significantly less horse.
Can you perhaps try to answer a recurring question that I have? Because you're a Final Fantasy player.
Yeah.
And you've played far more Legend of Zelda games than I have.
Mm-hmm.
Do people tolerate or enjoy silent protagonists?
That's a really good question. And that's a question that I think the answer is also somewhat in its time as well. Like, nowadays, silent protagonists are definitely I guess, like, hopefully everyone else has enough personality to make up for it. I feel like it was easier to give that a pass back then. And I don't know why. Honestly, like, your main character should be a character, right? And Link, poor Link, just has never quite gotten there.
The point that really drove home the absurdity of the situation was, there's a part early on in the Kokiri village.
Yeah.
Where, actually several points, frankly, where Link clearly says something. Because the interlocutor responds to a thing that Link is supposed to have said, but the game refuses to represent that he has said anything. It's so perverse and bizarre. And besides yeah. which, if Link spoke more, Navi would have to speak less. So there's that.
Yeah, I don't know. I definitely feel, especially nowadays, that it's tolerated, if that. Even Dragon Age Origins, which granted is quite dated at this point, that having a silent protagonist was still like, oh. I don't know. And I mean, you give them a voice with your dialogue options, but I don't
care if they don't have voice samples. I really don't. Like the Knights of the Old Republic games, Dragon sure. Age Origins, I had no problem. I wouldn't even call them silent protagonists.
That's fair.
They just didn't
yeah.
have voice acting. Because it's just so perverse to have this character stand there and have people yammer around them. It's mm-hmm. so strange. And I'll be serious here. If you wanted to make a character who's actually mute, that might be interesting. But instead, they're not represented as actually being mute. They're just strangely yeah. silent in ways that nobody who could speak would be.
Yeah, like the true silent protagonist has barely any personality. And I'm trying to think Because you mentioned Final Fantasy specifically, and obviously the very old Final Fantasy games. I mean, none of the characters had personality. But yeah. I'm trying to think of one where they don't actually speak at all. And maybe... Yeah, I don't know. I'm having trouble thinking of one where you have a silent protagonist in a Final Fantasy game that isn't, like, before 4. But it's been a long time since I played any of those as well. But Link is, like, an obvious example.
So is he still a silent protagonist in, like, Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, man. They are really devoted to that, then.
Yeah.
Woof.
Yeah, because I can't recall him ever speaking. And of course, I'm doubting myself now, but I'm pretty sure he's silent.
Okay. Well, yeah. It's definitely sapped any enthusiasm I had to go try to Breath of the Wild.
But that's also a horse game.
Look, how about we compromise? If there was a Zelda game where it was modded, so that instead of playing as Link, you played as Mr. Egg, the talking horse,
okay,
I'd be there.
All right. And
again, just to be perfectly clear, it's not that I want the main character to be brimming with personality,
sure,
or whatever. They can be a cipher. That's fine. But just not somebody whose inability to utter language makes it so transparently obvious and contrived and silly sounding.
Yeah.
That's my objection. There's got to be a game where you play as a mute individual. There's got to be. And I'm curious to go find one.
Hmm.
All right, so that's Scabbing Opinions on Old School Funware Goof. I preferred the Minish Cap, I got to say. Sorry, I thought Minish Cap was better. I did. Before we go on to our feature game, a brief break for our sponsors.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
And we're back.
So we're going to be moving on to our feature title, Raven's Watch. Raven's Watch came out earlier this year in September 2024. It's out for PC, PS5, Switch, PS4. So it's a roguelike game. It has multiplayer. Mark and I even played it together a little bit. Mark, can you give a gist of Raven's Watch, please?
It's a roguelite MOBA. I've never played a game that feels more like League of Legends than Raven's Watch.
Hmm.
Because I played Pastek's previous roguelite action game, Curse of the Dead Gods, a few years ago. And so I was completely unprepared for how staid the pacing is in terms of playing Raven's Watch. It is a very deliberate pace, both in terms of how your characters move, how your enemies move, how reactions work, how damage accrues. There's a certain dynamic that you need to be conscious of when playing games like League of Legends or Raven's Watch, which is to say your enemies have a lot of hit points. And so sometimes you might get frustrated or impatient. You figure, okay, I'm just going to wail on them until they're dead. They will kill you first.
Yeah, they will.
Right? Because you need to hit your enemy roughly 10 times as many times as they need to hit you. So in order to get good, or at least do any progress at Raven's Watch, you need to pile on the status effects, pile on the special attacks, know their attack patterns to a certain extent, dodge and get out the way, because there's no such thing as tanking in Raven's Watch in very much the same way that tanks in League of Legends aren't nearly as tanky as they are in other contexts. Like, I'm not going to say, I'm not a League expert, by the way. I played a very, very small amount a long time ago. But one of the things that struck with me was this strange kind of pacing that it has and the odd fragility of your main characters, especially when coupled with how bullet spongy all your enemies tend to be. And I found this very, very disorienting. But it is not a MOBA. It is a roguelite, so you get a variety of upgrades over the course of a run. When you die, you lose all of them, but there's some permanent progression in the sense that new unlocks get added to your available pool. Mm-hmm. You don't unlock a whole heck of a lot in terms of permanent buffs. You unlock new costumes, you unlock new story chapters and things like that. It is very much built around the co-op conceit, because the abilities that your characters have tend to play much, much better when you are building them with an eye towards cooperating with your fellow players.
The day that we played was the first time I had played Raven's Watch, so I had no idea what was going on.
Did you play the tutorial?
Who do you think I am, Mark?
This is a rhetorical question, Caitlin. There ain't no tutorial.
Right. We even discussed that, and I forgot. Yeah, there's no tutorial.
There should be.
Yeah, because it's like, hey, you have another special, or your special is going to do 20% more damage. I'm like, okay, I don't know which ability that is, but eventually I will figure it out.
And you're going to need to know what the symbols on the map mean. You're going to need to know mm-hmm. how to teleport to the fast travel places. And the game won't even bother to tell you how to so much as even open your map, let alone how and when you can teleport to various places. I was quite frankly stunned by the I assumed I skipped something by accident.
Yeah.
Because I'm a tutorial kind of guy, and I load it up, and I start with the first character, who, by the way, I don't think the first character was a very good choice for first character, but that's a separate issue. And it's like, oh, well, you know, this will influence your special ability. This will influence your power ability. I'm like, which one's which?
Yeah. What?
It does not spend any effort trying to tell you how anything works. Which, now, to be fair, this isn't Caves of Cud. This isn't even really Sifu, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like there's a whole lot of system mastery going on. It's just, I was quite surprised by how little they spend trying to situate what's going on.
I played with controller. I never played with mouse and keyboard. So I don't know if maybe there would be a little bit more information, because there's not really... Maybe not a good way to show tooltips if you're playing with a controller, but still, I don't know. I was surprised at, I mean, you learn while you're playing, and eventually you get the hang of it, but hopefully you're patient enough to stick around for that learning.
On top of this, the menu system between runs as you're setting up games is one of the worst I've seen in recent memory.
Yeah.
So I've been playing Raven's Watch for a couple of weeks now. I am pretty neat. I've tried every character. I've completed runs. I've gotten to the last boss. I've done the whole thing. I know how the systems work. I still don't remember how the menus work. I have to relearn every time simple things like, okay, where do I access the page to remind myself how the abilities work? How do I change costumes? How do I access the lobby? Every time, it's like I'm learning from scratch. And I have to, it's just the least intuitive menu setup that I've seen in quite some time. I don't know if it'd be easier with a keyboard or not, but it's just bafflingly bad.
Even the button to start your run was weird to me. Like, I was playing on an Xbox controller, so it was Y to ready up. And even if you're the only person in the game, you still need to hit Y to ready up in order to go. And I would just be like, okay, A, nope, that's going to change my character. Okay, do I need to, like, no. Much less intuitive than I thought it would be.
I don't remember Curse of the Dead Gods. Now, granted, it wasn't multiplayer.
Sure.
And you didn't have your choice of character select. So, granted, the menu system in Raven's Watch is going to be a lot more complicated than Curse of the Dead Gods. But frankly, it's like they felt the perverse need to reinvent the wheel, and or it was designed by a team of people who'd never played a game with a menu system before. It's really strange. But anyway... Once you actually launch into the game and you're deposited unceremoniously without explanation and told to start picking your first upgrades, don't worry, the time limit hasn't started before you leave the starting area. Oh, did I say there was a time limit? There's a day-night cycle in Raven's Watch that the game will not explain to you,
yep.
Even though the recommended starting character, their abilities are chained very much to the diurnal cycle of Raven's Watch. Strange decision piled on top of strange decision. Now, having... ragged on it all this time. I will say this, because this I think is a reasonable segue. I think, very much like League of Legends or a lot of other MOBAs, the character differentiation is extraordinarily well done in Raven's Watch, I think.
I've only played a couple characters. I played Scarlet, who I agree, not the best first character, especially because, like, I mean, I don't know. I could never get a hand of playing Scarlet when she's in her human form. I found wolf, you know, werewolf form to be much easier to deal with. Plus, werewolf form can heal itself, which, yes, please, thank you. Yeah, found that really tricky. The other character I played was the Frost Mage character, who I found very fun. And in general, with this game, I feel like melee is going to be very difficult for starters. I did much better playing on the ranged mage character than I did with Scarlet.
They are vastly easier to start, that is for sure. This is true solo, this is also true multiplayer. Ranged characters, I personally have found, and other people that I've spoken to playing it for the first time, find ranged characters much easier to get started with. The game didn't make any sense to me until I started playing Pied Piper.
Mm-hmm.
Pied Piper was the first character where it's like, oh, okay, I kind of understand how this game works. Before that, Raven's Watch was totally, totally opaque to me. That having been said, I also find that even in the context of ranged characters or even in the context of melee characters, there's a tremendous room for personal preference and personality to shine through in terms of what you play. Like, for example, I am completely astounded at how much more effective I am using Sun Wukong or Aladdin when compared to even other melee characters, even ones that deploy drones like Geppetto or like Beowulf. And so, again, I take this to be a testament to how different each character is and how they each have their own kind of subsystems and upgrade paths.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them will gel with some players and some won't. And I really did enjoy discovering all the mechanical intricacies of all the other characters. It's extraordinarily well done, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, So, like I said, I've only really played the two characters so far, but I'm excited to try out the others and learn them because they do feel very different from each other. And it's fun getting to see what direction you can bring each one in with their talent trees, I guess. It's calling it a talents tree is maybe a little weird because you never see it in like tree format, but your talents that you get to pick every time you level up.
It's a tremendous amount of effort and a lot of design work. Given the amount of differentiation of the characters, for each of them have their own unique upgrades. Like, there are no generic upgrades in terms of your level ups. It's not like plus 10% to melee combat. No, yeah. It's like when you are using this character's specific sub-mechanisms in this particular way, you get to do this cool thing. So it's a little churlish. I wish there were a little bit more. I feel like I've seen a lot of them already, and the rate at which new ones are introduced into the upgrade pool are a little bit too slow for my liking. But again, I recognize that that's the design burden they had, given how much differentiation is already baked into the design.
Mm-hmm.
So I very much appreciate the character differentiation. What did you think of the writing?
Nah, like, I mean, the characters all... Okay, so playstyle-wise, fun, unique, exciting... Personality-wise, pretty standard, felt a little tropey, like, you know, sad Frost Mage out of the box.
It's all fairy tale characters. It's a dark reimagining of fairy tales. On the topic of time capsules.
Yeah, right? When have we seen that before?
When we played The Wolf Among Us, the Fable story game, it was already long in the tooth by the time The Wolf Among Us got released.
Yeah.
Right? And on top of that, I think the execution is mediocre. You know, there's some dialogue and quips and lines that characters exchange with each other when you're playing in co-op. And I respect the fact that they went to the bother of giving each character unique interactions with every other character.
Yeah.
But honestly, I don't think the execution is there.
Well, how many times did we hear the same terrible joke between Scarlet and the Pied Piper? Like, oh, God.
Yeah. There's not enough, and they're bad. And frankly, I am sick to death of getting voice actors to deploy their stock of regional accents.
Hmm.
And sure enough, you know, I looked up who the voice actor for Aladdin is, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's a German guy. And he sounds like a German guy doing a voice.
Yeah.
And it just, I honestly, ever since playing Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, in what I'm going to call the original Farsi. I know it's not the original, yeah. But, you know, it's kind of like saying you haven't seen Hamlet until it's performed in the original Klingon. But having seen that done in the original Farsi, like, look, if you're going to have this bunch of stereotypes, I'm not going to tell you to cast a wolf for Scarlet when she's turned into a wolf.
Sure.
But as far as Aladdin is concerned, as far as Geppetto is concerned, if you, like, don't have some dude whip out his stock Italian dialect thing. It made the subpar writing even more grating in mm-hmm. my experience.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. It's like we have the capability in, you know, in this era to get people who are from Italy, you know, who have a natural Italian accent, or at least, you know, like we can do that. We don't need to hire somebody to make up an accent.
So look, maybe the guy who voiced Geppetto is Italian or of Italian extraction. I could definitely say that it sounds like a bunch of guys just whipping out their, you know, their stock regional accents.
Sure.
And it definitely doesn't make the poor writing sound any better. And so ultimately, I don't like the conceit. I don't like how it was executed. But as a framework for highly asymmetric characters to go out and fight some battles in a PvE context, I think it, you know, it's serviceable enough. That having been said, I mean, we do have to gesture towards the Hades of it all. In some sense, they're trying to be very different kinds of games, right? Because mm-hmm. Hades, not entirely unlike Dead Cells, is a much faster-paced game where there's a lot of fluid motion, as opposed to, as I said, the pacing of Raven's Watch. The movement abilities are much more staid, much more deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to play accordingly. But when Hades exists, and the voice acting is that good, and the writing is that good, and the characterization is that good, and the combat is that good, and everything else is all that good, I'm not saying that one obsoletes the other. I'm just saying that Raven's Watch is pretty good, but it didn't thrill me.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, it's like, is a comparison even fair here? Is comparing anything to Hades fair?
Isometric action roguelites. I mean,
yeah.
But yes. It's kind of like a few weeks ago when we were comparing platformers to Super Mario World. I'm like, nothing is going to come out looking very good from that perspective. But this does at least have the virtue that it has a co-op structure,
mm-hmm.
and you get to play with your friends, and, you know, some abilities get to be spec'd differently because you know you're playing with other people with different abilities. Like, when I saw that my colleague at one point had an ability that clustered people around, and I then got an explosive upgrade as an option, I'm like, well, clearly I'll do that. And we were playing to each other's strengths, and it was really cool.
Yeah.
And that was well done. But when it comes to Raven's Watch, which succeeds admirably on a lot of mechanical elements, but fails on a lot of others, I can't help but be reminded that there are other games of this precise genre that succeed on all fronts. I'll assume that you did not play Curse of the Dead Gods.
I did not.
It had more of a straightforward kind of style, but it was pretty effective, frankly. I remember enjoying it. So what did you think of Raven's Watch, Caitlin?
Well, I enjoyed it quite a bit. I'm definitely planning to play some more, especially with the co-op. Yeah, so the first time I played, which was with you, having to learn everything all at once was very challenging. Having to learn, like, what is my special? What is my trait? Oh, by the way, we need to pay attention to this guy because he's about to do a big cone of fire in front of him. Like, being able to pay attention to everything all at the same time was very challenging. Even on my third playthrough, I was finding all of that much easier to handle. I'd finally gotten the gist that, like, okay, I think my special is this button, and that's going to be the same for all the characters. That all helped. It's having a lot of fun. I'm definitely going to play some more because I do want to try out more of the characters and also hopefully beat it eventually.
Indeed, there's supposed to be a free upgrade in a few months. They're going to be releasing two new characters that can only be played multiplayer.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that is pretty exciting. One last complaint, because I think it's worth emphasizing.
Sure.
Those stupid area of effect attacks, I find it very difficult to tell when you're safe and when you're in danger.
Mm.
There are these red circles that show up on the ground, and the number of times I've died when I could have sworn that both of my characters' feet were outside that radius.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. That's something that actually reminds me, because Final Fantasy XIV also has, like, you know, these big telegraphed things. You need to get out of them. Final Fantasy XIV suffers, or not suffers, I don't know. It might be a design decision, I don't know, but something called snapshotting, where you look like you're fully out, but the server is pretty sure that you were in there, and therefore you take damage. So you have to be really careful within, like, the last half second or sometimes a second of when something is happening in order to not get hit by stuff like that. But Final Fantasy XIV has a bit of a slower pace, even in the raid content, than Raven's Watch does, I think. Because there were a lot of times in Raven's Watch where it's like, you better hit your moving ability if you have one, or you're just not getting out of this.
So that's Raven's Watch. Clever in some areas, less so in others. I, too, will be playing a little bit more, I think. And we now move on to shameless hyping of upcoming titles. What would you like to shout out, Caitlin?
So I thought it was kind of great that you mentioned The Wolf Among Us, because I'm shouting out Dispatch, which is from some of the writers and directors of The Wolf Among Us.
Ooh.
It is a superhero workplace comedy that's set in modern-day Los Angeles. And you are, I believe you play a washed-up superhero, and you're basically the superhero 911 dispatcher. So there will be an incident, and you have to pick which superheroes to send to go take care of it. I believe there's some kind of progression system where you have to, like, you know, you can build up the different superheroes' abilities to be able to do certain things well. So anyway, I saw a trailer for it at the Game Awards, and I thought it looked so cool. And it had, like, a cute little sense of humor and stuff. I liked the art. So I'm looking forward to Dispatch. It should be out 2025, apparently. So we'll see.
That is amazing. I very much enjoyed Wolf Among Us. We had a very good conversation about Wolf Among Us,
yeah.
Primarily about corruption. You know, I can make almost any video game a story about institutions, but
yeah.
Wolf Among Us kind of leaned into that. And The Walking Dead Season 1 is probably one of my favorite digital stories of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And it moved me in a lot of ways. Strangely enough, I've never played any of the later Walking Dead seasons. Maybe I should get to... Maybe that should get on my list of things to do.
Yeah. I think I played Season 1. Season 2, I don't remember if I ever finished.
I found Clementine less interesting than the other characters, so that's primarily why I didn't keep playing.
But yeah. Anyway.
Yes, Dispatch looks amazing. I would like to shout out a game that basically I've already purchased a number of times, and I'm probably going to purchase it one more time, and that is King of Fighters 13 Global Match for Steam.
Very nice.
This time with rollback, because the global match format, the sort of tagline to it, already exists in the PS4 and the Switch versions, and now they're going to be bringing those underlying, under-the-hood improvements to Steam. Still no crossplay, though. Which is unfortunate, but I think the King of Fighters 13 is the greatest fighting game of all time. It is absolutely stunning, both in terms of visuals and in terms of gameplay, and I'm very glad that they're going to be upgrading it again, and if they want me to purchase the game 7 more times, I will purchase King of Fighters 13 7 more times.
You're nothing if not consistent.
Well, you have a whole bunch of games that you've never played.
Yeah.
I can just repurchase the game that I keep playing.
Yeah, I mean, at least one of us is getting some bang for their buck.
I don't know that either one of us is necessarily getting good value for this economic transaction. I was trying to equate them in terms of lunacy, but you can interpret it however you want.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. For All My Best Friends Are Digital. We hope to see you again soon, and please do take care.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.